Strange and Charming, a podcast by physicists about life and science.
So hello everyone to our podcast, to Strange and Charming Chats with Physicists. So my name is Hinda, I'm a PhD student at KIT. And today I'll be interviewing my PhD supervisor, Felix Kahlhöfer, who's a junior professor in theoretical particle physics at KIT. His main research topic is dark matter, and well, I'm going to introduce him a little bit for our listeners. He did his undergrad in Heidelberg, his PhD in Oxford, then moved for a postdoc to Desi in Hamburg. He worked for a few years in Aachen, and recently, 1.5 years ago, you might correct me if I'm wrong, he moved to Karlsruhe. And so I Googled him, of course, to prepare for this interview. Felix managed to get to publish over 100 papers in these last 10 years. He's a father of 3 years old. This is not something you find on the internet, but I know. And he is also the winner of Jugendforscht of 2004. So if you Google Felix, you will find his picture as a 17-year-old. And so I thought, okay, this is a good start actually for the questions of our podcast. So maybe you are, well, obviously really motivated or really passionate for physics already as a high schooler. And I was wondering what sparked that first motivation. So were there special events or people in your teenagehood or maybe childhood?
So, okay, nice. That's a great place to start. First of all, hi, everyone. And many thanks, Henda, for helping make this happen. So when I was a teenager, it wasn't clear to me at all that I would be studying physics. I enjoyed maths, but I also enjoyed various other things. I liked reading and politics, and there were many kind of career paths that I could imagine. And it was, in a sense, through Jugendforscht that I ended up studying physics. The way this happened is that I first wrote what is called a Facharbeit, so this is a short research project in high school, in physics. And I had a spectacular physics teacher. I knew him for many years, and I had essentially chosen physics as an A-level subject specifically because I liked him as a teacher, and I liked his approach to giving hands-on projects and experiments and discussing with students and so on. So then when he proposed a Facharbeit with him, I was very excited. And I don't actually remember if he came up with the topic or if I came up with it, but I just started working on it. It became longer and longer. It grew far beyond kind of what you would normally do for a Facharbeit. And then at some point he said, yeah, why not submit this to Jugendforscht? And that's what I did. And then the way this works is that you go from round to round. Like there's a regional round and there's a statewide round, and then eventually there's a federal round. And I kept somehow progressing through the stages, and I was enjoying it a lot, meeting lots of very clever and excited students who did all kinds of things in the natural sciences. And yeah, eventually I ended up winning the competition, which in a sense, as you said, Henda, is maybe my main claim to fame. It's the only place where my name actually appears on Wikipedia in the article on ping pong balls. So what I did, I should say maybe, was to study chaotic behavior. So it's already getting chaotic in ping pong balls bouncing on oscillating tables. Which is pretty cool. You can learn a lot about chaos in physics. And yeah, people, I think, enjoyed the fact that there was both maths in it and an actual hands-on experiment, maybe the only experiment I ever successfully carried out in my career. So yeah, this is kind of how I actually started realizing that I enjoy physics. even at that point, it wasn't clear for me that this means that I should study physics. In particular, at that point, I wasn't sure that you can somehow make a meaningful contribution to society as a physicist. But what really then, what I started realizing through this whole process of Jugendforscht and so on, is that the contribution that you make, in a sense, comes through the teaching and the communication, right? So getting people into science and, you know, improving literacy for science and the scientific method in society. And in a sense, that was then kind of the point where I realized that this is something that I enjoy doing and that I can see myself doing more long term.
Interesting. You already answered one of the questions I was actually planning to ask you later on in the podcast. So like this issue we might have, in a sense, so like we're doing fundamental research and how to be sure that we're still doing something that is meaningful for the society. So that's a very interesting point. But you said there were also other options, other career options you thought of as a teenager. So what would you have been if you weren't a physicist? What is like the most probable thing?
Interesting question. I think at the time when I started studying, I was quite intrigued by computer linguistics because I liked programming, but I also really liked language and I liked reading a lot. Somehow this is, I guess, a field which has completely changed in the 20 years since I thought about studying it. So thinking back now, I guess I could have been also part of a very interesting development. But then again, I think also now computer scientists and artificial intelligence and so on have so completely taken over that field that it's hard to tell where that career would have gone exactly. But I even contemplated doing things not connected to natural sciences at all, like really studying full-time literature. Even at some point, I considered studying theology, so there were really a lot of things on the table.
So maybe going back to Felix as a high schooler, which was your least favorite subject in school? Or were you like enthusiastic about all kinds of topics?
I think really the honest answer for that is mathematics.
Really?
as strange as that sounds. Because I was never quite satisfied with it. I mean, I guess I did a lot of maths in my free time. I also participated in these maths Olympics and so on, and I met a lot of people who, you know, did much more advanced maths than what you would do in school. And then at some point it just becomes very boring. And I think I must have been a complete nightmare for my teachers, because this is the last person you want to have in class. At some point, we actually reached an agreement where I didn't attend all the maths classes, but would instead take like first year level maths courses at university, which worked well for me and I think was good news for my teacher as well. So that was the solution that we found. I think other than that, I was reasonably happy with most courses, really.
Going back to the beginnings of your studies, did you ever expect that you would get to this point where you have a research group with four PhD students, also a few postdocs, and more master and bachelor students? So you're having a group of almost like 10 people, and we're doing research.
I think I was actually very naive about all of this. I never somehow thought this through. I always just tried to do things that I enjoy at that moment and didn't really, you know, make strategic decisions where that would lead me. Like I didn't plan I have to attend this lecture in order to do my whatever diploma thesis with this particular famous professor, so that I then would go on to get that PhD position and so on. This is somehow not how things worked for me, and I also think it all felt very intransparent. There was absolutely no notion as a student for what you would have to do to become a professor. The only thing we knew is that it probably was not getting good at teaching, at least not for all of the professors. We figured you have to be clever and you have to somehow find your thing that you like to do, but there was no kind of obvious path. And in a sense, I think this is still, I would still see that as the correct approach in retrospect, right? There is no way that you plan an academic career from start to finish. There's a degree of luck, you know, finding interesting people to work with, interesting topics to work on, and so on. There's also certainly some degree of determination or flexibility that, you know, you also switch topics or you move places depending on what's interesting. But other than that, I think really you can't do much more than just, do what you think you like. And this actually for me also wasn't a straight path. When I started studying physics, I was mostly focused, in fact, on environmental physics and climate science, until I realized how much I sucked at lab work. So the chemistry undergraduate lab was the worst thing I've done in my degree. And I think at that point it became increasingly clear to me that I should stick with equations and computers. And then somehow, kind of gradually, I enjoyed the math lectures. I ended up taking more math lectures. I switched minor subject from chemistry to mathematics. And then kind of from there, it was a kind of smooth transition towards the kind of physics that I do now.
Yeah, I find this actually quite relatable, because I also figured out sometime in the undergrad that I was really, really bad in all the experimental parts. Like, I'm really grateful that there are a lot of people who are working on the experiments and they're good at it, but I'm definitely not that kind of person. And so I also, that's why like my path into physics and also into doing now a PhD in theoretical physics felt at some point also like a random walk into it. So it's soothing to hear that for you it was maybe somewhat similar. It
also went the other way, by the way. When I realized that I would go more into theoretical physics, I went to Cambridge for an exchange program and did like a one-year master's degree. And I also realized that I don't want to do mathematical physics. So I attended lectures on string theory and group theory and all of these, you know, very abstract mathematical foundations of physics. And I realized that that's also not what I want to do. That was, for me, too abstract and too disconnected from where, in a sense, the experiments happen, where somehow, you know, you really discover new facts of nature. And then I somehow settled for this halfway in between equilibrium, which is sometimes called phenomenology, so predicting observable phenomena from underlying theories, and then looking at the data and actually trying to work out what it means.
Yeah, actually also fits well with what you said earlier about that you found a sense in doing science and research also in this part where you communicate what you're doing. And so I think in Pheno, that's kind of what you do. You communicate between like the theoretical part and the experimentalists. So since we're talking about experiments, some of the people in the group, so to actually find the questions I needed for this interview, I also asked other people in our research group and also people from the conference last week. And some of them wanted to know which is your favorite future experiment and also which is your favorite past experiment. might be a bit political for physicists.
I like that question because for me, my career has always been very close to experiments. So from kind of the first days in my diploma thesis, I somehow always work together with experimentalists. And to some degree, I think the answer to that question is also just based on personal experience, like people that I enjoyed working with and people that I exchanged a lot of ideas with, that I learned from a lot. I think regarding past experiments, there should be without doubt the xenon experiment. So the experiment trying to directly detect dark matter scattering in underground detectors. And this is kind of how I first got into the field of dark matter. Actually, when I started, this is another one of these unpredictable things. When I started writing my diploma thesis, I went to my supervisor and said, I want to work on neutrinos. I don't want to work on dark matter. And within 2 months, he had me working on dark matter. He said, this is what needs to be done now. This is growing. This will be big. You should work on it. And he was right. And I kind of sat down and started studying what people had done. And very quickly, we realized that there was this very exciting experimental idea of how you could potentially detect dark matter particles. And a lot of what I know about the field and how I see it was very much shaped by this technology and the things that became possible essentially over the last 10 years. I mean, the improvements in sensitivity are absolutely mind-blowing. It's been orders and orders of magnitude. It's uncomparable to, I think, what has been achieved in almost any other branch of physics. So yeah, I think that's a relatively easy answer. In terms of future experiments, I'm not someone to spend a lot of time thinking about experiments that will be built in 30 or 40 years. I feel that this is somehow ironically a task for those who will not live to see those experiments being finished. This is something that you do just before or after your retirement. So for me, this has to be an experiment that's realistic, that can happen within the next decade, say, or maybe even an experiment that's actually already running, and you just need to look at it at a different angle to realize what might actually be achievable. In the second category, one name that definitely comes to mind is the Bell 2 experiment, which is already running, is working beautifully and taking lots of data. But what's really exciting from my point of view is that people are beginning to understand all the different ways in which you can actually use the detector to look for types of new physics that weren't really on the agenda when the experiment was built. And this is very funny because I actually worked on a document discussing the kind of physics case for Bell 2, and I worked on something that ended up being a very small part of a very big document and has since only grown in interest and in the number of people working on it and the number of papers published on it, which is looking for light, very weakly coupled particles beyond the standard model. And I think what Bell 2 can do in this field is very impressive and will be very exciting. In terms of experiments that are not yet built, I think what is really truly exciting is the opportunity to send a gravitational wave observatory to space. I think what probably has changed most in the way we see nature since I started studying physics is that it has become possible to observe gravitational waves. I think this was definitely, when I heard about this for the first time, it seemed to me completely outlandish, complete science fiction, that you would ever be able to do it. And now it's become a standard way almost of studying the universe. But of course, we need to make that window larger. We need to look at different frequencies, improve our sensitivity, and so on. And if we manage to build and run something like the LISA Gravitational Wave Observatory, this will be spectacular. So I'm very excited about that.
Me too. I'm also very looking forward to what LISA will show us and maybe other gravitational waves experiments. Yeah, and another question I want to ask you is, what is your favorite dark matter candidate, or which scenario would be, like, if it were true and if we could detect it, which would be your favorite dark matter scenario?
It's interesting how little we often think about this question, right? Because we are somehow used to being a bit more neutral in the sense that we work on many different ideas simultaneously, but then sometimes you realize kind of the profound implications of actually observing one of these particles, right? And then if you somehow pause to think about that for a moment, you realize how much of a game changer that would be, right? Knowing that there exists another particle that is actually more abundant than any other particle we know. That will be spectacular. From that point of view, in a sense of the kind of transformation that would come from such a discovery, I think axions are a very exciting dark matter candidate. And without going into any details, what I find fascinating about axions is that they are extremely light, much lighter than any other particle that we know, which means that you need to have a huge number of them to explain the observations that dark matter exists in the universe. And essentially then the implication of this is, if you think about it, is that really space is filled with this kind of fluid, this energy density of these particles that are just everywhere. They are just sitting there and they are hugely abundant. And we could potentially take some of them and somehow convert them into observable signals. I think this would really be spectacular. So in a sense, I guess this is the particle that I would be most excited about.
Yeah, me too. So I guess it answers also one of the questions I wanted to ask you, but you might have a different answer. So if you could choose, like if you could really choose what the next big discovery in physics is, what would it be? Would that be dark matter detection? Or?
Yeah, I think it's hard to think of anything more spectacular, more groundbreaking than that. And in particular, staying with the idea of axions for a moment, what's amazing about the ways in which we search for axions is that the discovery may actually be extremely sudden. So the way these experiments work is that you try to convert axions into observable light, into photons, but you can only do that at a fixed frequency at any given time. So effectively you have to scan. You have an experiment called a cavity, which you set to a specific frequency, and then you try and see if axions exist at exactly that frequency. And if you don't see anything, you change the frequency slightly. So just like, you know, you would tune your radio, you change the frequency, you look for axions at a different frequency. And just like a radio, as soon as you hit the right frequency, the signal is crystal clear. So you hit the frequency, the signal is there. You just know within a day, you know for sure that you've discovered dark matter, and you can actually, you know, you can listen to the signal in a sense. You can figure out what are the properties of these particles, how do they distribute in the Milky Way, what kinds of structures do they have, and so on. And if that happens, It will be completely mind-blowing.
Now I have a rather classical question for a physicist. Do you think there's life somewhere else in the universe?
I find it almost inconceivable that there shouldn't be, right? It's somehow for me very hard to imagine that that we are the product of such an incredible coincidence that this could not possibly happen anywhere else. So it's not actually a question that I think about very much, because it seems to me that the practical implications of discovering life somewhere else in the universe would be relatively small. But then again, maybe I shouldn't talk about practical implications when I work on dark matter searches. So, of course, I mean, for me, it's perfectly conceivable that we see signs of life from an exoplanet, and that would obviously also change the way that we view the universe.
Okay, now maybe going back to the career and life of a researcher, would you like to tell us about some of the struggles maybe you faced in the last 10 years, and like also maybe the dark side, let's say, of our life as researchers?
So I think it's worth saying, first of all, that I have been relatively lucky. I was never at a point when I had to make extremely difficult decisions regarding, for example, work and family. So in fact, when I went to the UK for my PhD, my wife also had a PhD position in the UK, then girlfriend, now wife, I should say. So this worked well for us. Then when I went back to Germany, within 2 years, she also found a job in Germany and also moved back. And in a sense, this is also then the reason why we decided to stay long term, at least for the foreseeable future in Germany. So from that point of view, I was never in a position where I suffered terribly from, you know, for example, being separated or being far away from people I care about. I think the most difficult moments are still the ones where you have to make a decision, right? So you look for PhD positions and you have several possibilities where you might go. You apply for postdoc positions, and if you're lucky, you get several offers for where you could go for a postdoc. Some people even have offers for several permanent positions that they need to decide between, which is not a problem I ever had. But of course, in all these cases, you have to make life-changing decisions, right? You're moving to country A or to country B, and your life will be completely different depending on what you decide. And these are, of course, moments where you have to somehow strike a balance. I think maybe the most complicated decision that I had to make in my career, and this is not a dark moment, but maybe just a difficult moment, was when I applied for my first independent funding, which is this Emmy Noether Junior Research Group program of the DFG. And before I actually heard back from the application, I got a very attractive postdoc offer. I could have gone to CERN for a fellowship, and I basically had to decide whether I would accept that offer and move there and essentially then retract my application for this fellowship, or if I take a risk and say I decline the offer and I wait to hear back from my application. And I did the latter, and it worked out. But if it hadn't worked out, then, you know, things could have gone very differently. So I think, in a sense, I often got lucky with the decisions I made. I think, other than that, the most difficult time that I've had in my research career, and this will be true for many listeners, I suspect, was the pandemic. This was with a one-year-old son who had basically started daycare just a few weeks before the first lockdown, and at a point where I had, for the first time, PhD students to supervise, postdocs in my group, master students that needed input from me, and so on. And that was, let's say, not easy. just in terms of, you know, trying to somehow find enough time for everyone, managing the day-to-day tasks in confinement, while somehow giving everyone who somehow relied on me the input and feedback they needed. But in a sense, in retrospect, it has been almost a liberation for me, because it was the point where I realized that it's never going to be perfect. You're never going to be able to achieve everything, make everyone perfectly happy, complete all of your to-do items by the end of the week. And once you accept that, it actually becomes easier. And you know, you realize you have to prioritize, and you have to sometimes say no, and you have to maybe also not achieve some of the things that you would have liked to do. But obviously, one of the things that were completely impossible for me at that time were optional things like attending virtual conferences, giving talks, and so on. So I basically declined all the invitations. But then suddenly it also gets somehow quiet and isolated, right? I think as physicists, we very much benefit from interactions and exchange and so on, much more than people would sometimes believe. And that's something that I found hard, that you're then somehow forced to rely on your own ideas and initiative and so on.
Yeah, it's difficult to find the balance, I guess, from like how many conferences you take part in and like how much time do you take for actually doing your own research. And when you have a whole group to take care of, it's much more difficult. But I think, well, I can speak for myself, but you're a great supervisor, so...
I try to be. As long as I don't run out of ideas, it should be all right.
Yeah, so maybe talking about our group, one of the observations one can make about it is, like, it's a very diverse group, and we're almost 50% women, which is, in theoretical physics, something extremely, extremely, extremely rare. And somehow you managed to create such a diverse and just like really nice group, friendly, like lots of friendly people, and I think we're all supportive to each other. And I think you played a big role, of course, in making sure that we have this constellation of people. So I wanted to know how to do it exactly.
So I mean, first of all, I should say that I'm of course extremely happy how things have turned out in the 1.5 years since I moved here. This is of course completely unpredictable. You start from scratch, more or less from zero, and you have to start recruiting people, look around, and you know, there are people that you would like to work with, and sometimes you can convince them, sometimes you can't, and then you can never predict how exactly the chemistry will work out, right? How people get along with each other, how somehow, you know, a group becomes some kind of coherent structure. So I think the first part to that is really very conscious decisions in recruiting, and this means first of all advertising positions widely, as opposed to, you know, just hiring the first person that comes to mind, someone you know, someone who's been recommended to you, to really open up the opportunities for people to apply, because very often that means, I mean, always this means that people will approach you who you didn't know and didn't have on your radar, and maybe also work on topics that you wouldn't have maybe immediately considered. And then at that point, I think it helps to be open for new ideas and new contributions. I mean, one of the reasons why I think it's important to have a diverse research group is that not everyone ends up doing the same things or being interested in the same things. And And I actually have a relatively broad range of interests, I think. And I also like thinking about ideas that I haven't explored. And that means that for me, in a sense, it works better to recruit people who do very different things or like different things, are interested in different things than what I maybe would have had in mind, and then just see where it goes. And then I think one thing that's, from my experience, extremely important is to really make an effort that the group never becomes too homogeneous in any way, because at that point it can be off-putting, right? People will see the group and think, I'm not sure I will fit. I'm not sure this is for me, right? And then it gets very, very difficult to build that up again. I don't think there's a recipe how to achieve that. I think the positive way to spin it is that once you've somehow created a certain environment, it just keeps going. It basically doesn't take a lot of effort to maintain it. Maybe I've been lucky that this actually worked this time around on such a short time scale as well.
Thank you. Did also put a lot of effort in it, so you don't. It's not only luck; it's also work.
Yeah, I guess what is work is to somehow, and this is underestimated sometimes, is making a group as opposed to a collection of individual researchers. In this regard, I've benefited hugely from my time in Aachen, where this was really spectacular in how master students were already very strongly integrated in the research groups, would participate actively in all the seminars and activities, and there were social activities every week and all kinds of things. People would have hours and hours of coffee breaks, playing cards or whatever, which at the end of the day actually probably leads to more research output than when everyone either works from home or spends kind of the minimum necessary time in the office. And I've been trying to copy that a bit.
Yeah, I think having the time to informally think and talk about physics can be very good for productivity.
I mean, we also work in an environment where you can't, you know, sit at your desk and think for 8 hours a day. It's not going to be productive. And of course, often there are tasks which are relatively stupid in the sense that, you know, you have to document something, you have to write a code that does a certain thing, and there's not much creativity in there. But then most of the time you actually have to figure out what you want to do, like what are you interested in, what are others going to be interested in, how do you present your results, how do you explain them, how do you make them, you know, appealing for others. And this is the part that, you know, if you're lucky, you do this for an hour per day, and that's normally enough.
I thought we might we could wrap up with which advice would you give to young researchers?
So one piece of advice that has worked well for me is to understand what you want, but not fixate on it too much. So I think this can go wrong in both directions. There are scientists who, in particular young scientists, who say everything is unpredictable. I have no idea what's going to happen to me. I will just, you know, do something, apply somewhere, see what happens, and then somehow go with the flow. And from my point of view, that's too passive an approach, in the sense that it helps having preferences. It helps saying, this is a city where I really would like to live, or this is a person that I really would like to work with. And sometimes I suppose people are afraid of saying this, because very often it will not work out. but it actually makes it less likely that it works out if you don't somehow, you know, commit. And it is, of course, possible. If you, you know, if there is someone that you want to work with, then go to that person and say them that you want to work with them. That will definitely increase the probability of something happening, right? So this kind of leap of faith that you say, I'm you know, willing to do something that might have some risk of going wrong, I think that's important. And then at the same time, you absolutely have to be able to live with things not working out the way you want. All the way to, you know, being open to the possibility that you might not make exactly the career that you had in mind. And I think it's clear, just, you know, from looking at the numbers, not everyone who writes a PhD thesis will end up having a permanent position at a university. And some people don't want to. They you know, maybe right after the PhD, they know that they prefer some other type of career. Some people would like to, but then, you know, things don't quite play out. And I think it's important somehow paying an attention to what are somehow the costs of those career choices and what are the benefits. And just to say that I know a lot of people who've left physics and a lot of them were maybe disappointed or upset at the moment, but essentially all of them ended up being happy with their choices. There are a lot of great jobs for physicists outside of universities, and there are many ways in which, you know, you can apply the things that you've learned, and even physicists can adopt to, you know, normal work environments with regular working hours and so on. It's not too hard. And there are a lot of ways, you know, to end up doing something fulfilling. So that's the flip side, right? Also don't invest too much or don't suffer too much when things aren't going exactly as you would like.
You'll be giving a talk in like 20 minutes or no, 1 hour. Do you still feel nervous before giving a talk? Does it go away at some point? When does it go away?
No, I think it never goes away completely. It's later for me now. So it used to be the case that I would never properly sleep before giving a talk. I was always so nervous that, you know, I couldn't get to sleep properly, and then I was even more nervous that I would mess up the talk because I would be super tired. And with fatherhood, this actually has changed. First, I am always very tired, so I go to sleep easily. And second, you realize the amount of things that you can do while you're tired, so that's fine. But I still get nervous, you know, when I see the audience, when I sit in the room and the speaker ahead of me, I don't know, gives a great talk and I think I have to match that. Or they give a horrible talk and you think, oh no, the audience is completely exhausted. And I think this is also good. I think it's good to have this kind of adrenaline push that gets you through a talk. And I think it's actually also important not to get too complacent and think, you know, you can just, you've given 100 talks, you will just wing it without somehow preparing. I really don't like giving the same talk several times, so I allow myself maybe 2 or 3 repetitions, but after that it has to be a different talk, just to make sure that, you know, you keep somehow exploring new ideas.
That the enthusiasm for the topic doesn't just go away. I think it gets boring at some point when you give the same talk over and over again. And so you might, or it feels like one stops giving or putting much effort into it.
Yeah, this is also something that I notice about myself, that I see other scientists and I somehow admire their stamina or their determination to, you know, work on very specific research problems for many, many years. And I realize this isn't for me, that I need somehow more variation I'm also maybe less motivated to go into kind of very high level of technical details, so really go into the depth of a specific question. But for me, having an overview, a kind of broader perspective, is more appealing. And in a sense, this is also what reflects, you know, the choices of topics that I work on, that I give talks about, and so on, that I like to have this ability to jump between ideas.
One last question. Do you work on weekends?
Almost never. And the first reason is that, of course, kindergartens are closed on weekends, so that significantly limits the ability to get work done. And the other is that I also very much enjoy the time with my family, leaving aside all the things that have to be done in the household on a weekend that you never get to otherwise. So what I do is I get up early. This is not really by choice. I just wake up early, and I often get like an hour or two of work done before my son wakes up, because he really does not like getting up early. But this is pretty much the only time that I would work on weekends, with, of course, exceptions. You know, there are deadlines and there are things that are very important, and then it's also reassuring to have this kind of buffer where you know that you have resources that you can tap into if it's really necessary. Like, it's overall relaxing to know that you're not at 100% capacity. You could do more if it's necessary, but so far it's working out all right. Let's see.
Thank you very much for answering all these questions and taking the time.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks. Yeah, I guess we could say goodbye to our listeners.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who joined. If you have questions about anything, research, you know, you want to work on dark matter, you know where to find us.
Yeah, thank you very much. Everyone who stumbled upon this podcast, you will see who it will reach at the end. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast was funded by the German Research Foundation through the Collaborative Research Center Transregio 257 P³H, Particle Physics Phenomenology After the Higgs Discovery.